wherever you are at. So again, lesson 159, the rules to be observed in translation, part 2. Last week in lesson 158, we looked at the rules to be observed in translation set forth by Bishop Bancroft to govern the project. All told, we consider the following general points. So this would be from last week. We looked at, number one, how the rules came about. We looked at what the rules were. And then third, we looked at some scholarly commentary on the purpose and function of the rules. So that's kind of what we did last time. Today in lesson 159, we want to consider to what extent the rules were actually followed by the King James translators when doing their work. Now, before we get too far into that, though, last week I mentioned how I had wanted to show you some images, but some of these images are copyrighted, and I couldn't just sort of throw them up or put them in the PowerPoint or in the notes because I've already kind of gotten my hand slapped once for that in the past for doing something. But I forgot the book at home that had the images in it. So last time we talked about this manuscript in the possession of the British Library that had handwritten by Bancroft what the rules were. Okay, it's something like Harley manuscript 750 or something. When you hear that kind of stuff, that's just technical language for how the thing is cataloged and entered into the records of the library or the museum. Okay, but here's the image of the 14 rules, and you can see the insignia of the British Museum stamped on this. So I'm going to put this up in front of the screen here for those that are online. So you can see the 14 rules here, and then I'll kind of show them to you guys that are here in person. So those 14 rules that we covered are, I covered them exactly the way they're set out here in the manuscript that's in the possession of the British Museum, all right? So the book I have, if you're interested in it, it's called Manifold Greatness, The Making of the King James Bible is the name of the book. And this was published in 2011 by the Bodleian Library as part of the commemoration of the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible. So there'll be other images probably from that book I'll show you in future lessons. But when we saw the rules laid out and the order and the way they were laid out, I did it the same way they appear on that document that I just showed you there, okay? So I just wanted you to see that image.
Does that document use the word rules?
Does it use the word rules? I believe so. I gotta find it again now.
Does rule mean the same thing then that it meant now if it did?
It says right here.
Rules.
The rules to be observed in translation. So I'll show that here too to the camera right there. It says the rules to be observed in the translation. So that's the document's language, not mine or somebody else's. I'm curious why you asked that.
Well, because a rule and a guideline are two different things entirely. And, you know, what we call a rule today is strict.
Yeah, okay, I see.
The guideline is loose.
Right, okay. Yeah, it does use the word rule. Okay. Now, as you have had the benefit of having read these already to help me in the proofreading, but we're going to see they end up kind of being more like guidelines in some ways than they do strict rules, but we'll get into that here as we get started. So the main point then that we're going to be looking at for the most of the time this morning is this one right here, to what extent the rules were followed, right? So let's get into it. While we touched on this subject briefly in certain places in lesson 158, the topic requires some further attention on account of the many misconceptions that people have about the matter. There's much confusion about the matter in pro-King James literature and teaching. For example, some maintain that Rule 1 was completely ignored in favor of William Tyndale. So if you look, Mike and Sylvia gave us this standalone sheet to remind, have so you can make reference to this as we're talking about the different rules. Rule 1, again, is the ordinary Bible in the church, commonly called the Bishop's Bible, to be followed and as little altered as the truth of the original will permit. So I listened to at least three videos just this week by King James advocates, King James only, as talking about this very topic of the rules and to what extent the rules were followed. And all three of those videos said that Rule 1 wasn't followed, that they didn't follow Rule number 1, and that it wasn't really a revision of the Bishop's Bible, and they had all these, you know, sort of reasons for that, okay? And what I'm saying here is the reason why we have to look at this particular topic of to what extent the rules were followed is because a lot of stuff has been said in pro-King James argumentation and literature, both in print and just in teaching, that just frankly, to put it bluntly, isn't true. It's just stuff's not true that has been said. All right. And again, I listened to 3 videos just this week from different teachers, and they all to a man said stuff about this issue that wasn't correct. Okay. While others leave one with the impression that all 15 rules were followed exactly the way they were drawn up without any deviation. So there's some guys who will say they followed it to a T. Okay. Others will say they followed everything to a T except rule 1. All right. And so there's all sorts of things that are said, and whether or not all that is true is what we need to be looking at in this particular lesson. Now, I'm going to tell you right now that the stuff I heard and the stuff I've read, largely I find to be inaccurate and not true by my own study of the matter, all right? So, Gordon Campbell does an excellent job addressing this question in his book, Bible, The Story of the King James Version, 1611 to 2011. To what extent were these guidelines followed? So you see right there, he calls them what?
Guidelines,
to Mike's point, okay? So let's, before we judge that too harshly, let's look at what he says. Anyone who has worked with untried procedures set out in advance of a project will be aware that the practicalities of implementation mean that some procedures will not be followed. So I made this point last week. In my professional life as an educator, just say, I've been involved in projects often where before the project starts, there's a set of rules, guidelines, whatever word you want to use for it, that says we're going to do it and we're going to follow A, B, C, and D. All right? And then you get into the project and you realize that A and B are redundant, you don't need them, and you end up only using A and D or whatever, you know. So some of them you end up saying, we don't really need, this is irrelevant, it doesn't matter. And you end up sometimes not following exactly the way you thought it was going to go before the project started, okay? Now, I'm sure some of you can relate to that, you know, on your jobs or what have you, or Bart, even you, maybe even with, you know, working on, you know, contractor stuff, you think something's going to go a certain way, and you get into it, and you're like, oh, wait, this isn't exactly what I thought it was, and so you end up having to do something different than what you originally thought, right? So that's the idea that Campbell's kind of talking about here. It is difficult to judge exactly how the translators worked, but there are several documents that afford glimpses into their practices. The most important of these, from the perspective of guiding principles, was the report by one of the translators of the Synod of Dort. Okay, now, I mentioned this last time, right? So, the rules begin to be drawn up in 1604 by Bancroft, right? The process takes a number of years, and the Bible is finally published in 1611. In 1618, and what's the guy's name again? I'm drawing a blank. Samuel Ward gives a report to the Synod of Dort reporting on the process that was used. So the report from 1618 is a retrospective. It is him saying after the fact, after the completion of the project, things about the project. The rules that Bancroft drew up were the rules as they were drawn up before it what? Started, right? So the rules show you the way they thought it should go in 1604 when the project was conceived and approved and drawn up, etc. Ward's report from 1618 is looking back now on the project after the project is completed. All right. So in 1618, 7 years after the King James Version had been published, the assembly, now known as the Synod of Dort, was convened in Dordrecht. By the Dutch Reformed Church to deal with the dispute between Calvinists and Arminians. Just as the Hampton Court Conference had commissioned a new version of the Bible, so the Synod of Dort approved a new translation of the Bible into Dutch. So there's a similarity there, okay? The 5 English delegates to the Synod include the resolute Calvinist Samuel Ward, a member of the Cambridge Company that translated the Apocrypha. So, there's 5 Englishmen that go to this Dutch meeting. The purpose of the meeting in 1618 is to discuss the theological debates between Calvin and Arminius over issues related to predestination and free will and all these sorts of things, right? We're not going to get into all that right now. That's a whole other issue that is, while interesting, immaterial to what we're talking about. Five Englishmen go to this meeting. One of them is Samuel Ward. Samuel Ward had worked on the apocryphal section of the King James Bible. At the meeting in the Netherlands, I'm assuming it's in the Netherlands here, they decide that they want a new Bible in Dutch. So one of the things they do is they ask Samuel Ward to report on what they did in England with the English Bible, namely the King James Bible. Okay, so let's read on. The five English delegates to the synod included the resolute Calvinist Samuel Ward, a member of the Cambridge Company that translated the Apocrypha. Ward submitted an account written in the international language of Latin, which set forth the procedures that govern the work of the King James Version. He also listed eight rules that had guided the process of translation. Although the first two simply summarize elements in the original 15 rules, the other six are in effect supplementary rules, okay? Because they were formulated retrospectively, and in Ward's Latin are sometimes phrased in the past tense. They have the inestimable advantage of reflecting on what actually happened rather than on what was supposed to happen, right? So understand, the rules set forth in 1604, they're saying this is what you should what? Do. This is how it should go. This is the procedure that you should follow. What Ward is talking about in 1618 now is looking back on, well, here's what we actually what? Here's what we actually did, okay? So if you want a full picture now of what actually happened, you have to take into account the 14-15 rules we went over last week, but you also have to take into account Ward's retrospective account now of what went on between 1604 and 1611. Now, let's stop there. Is everybody following this? Anybody got any questions? Okay, so let's look at what he said. And by the way, I don't have the PDF called up, but there's a book by a gentleman named Wood that was published, is that his name? No, Pollock, in which the whole report of Ward is given, translated into English out of the Latin. Okay, and I have that book in my collection of online books, but let's look at what he says. So this is from what Ward said. The translators were not being asked to create a new version of the Bible, but rather to revise the established version, removing any blemishes or inaccuracies. So who said that? Ward said that. When did he say it? He said it in 1618, right? So he's saying, is it his testimony before the Synod of Dort, that this was a revision of the previous Bible?
Yeah.
That's what he said. Okay? Now, if we're going to trust him, should we be able to find some evidence of that?
Yes.
Yes. So we'll get to that in a minute. Parallel passages would be recorded in the margin, but there would be no marginal commentary. Okay? So if you look at your standalone sheet there, that would be number six, rule six. No marginal notes are to be affixed, etc. Okay? Rule one would be the first statement. Look at the next bit. Where a Hebrew or Greek word admits two meanings of a subtle kind, the one was expressed in the text, the other in the margin. Okay, so that's another category of marginal notes. So Ward said when they encountered a Hebrew or a Greek word that could realistically be translated one of two ways, they made a choice to put one in the text and the other where?
In the margin.
Okay? Now, that should tell you something. Are the translators themselves, by that practice, acknowledging that there might be more than one way of saying what the text said? Hello. Okay. They're doing that because they recognize that as a reality. Let's go on. So for those of you that are following along here, I'm on page 2 in this section right here. Where a Hebrew or Greek word admits two meanings of a subtle kind, the one was expressed in the text, the other in the margin. The same to be done where variant readings were found in different but reputable versions of the Hebrew and Greek texts. Does the King James 1611 talk about variant readings? It does, in the margin. Now, this is a point that I feel that many King James advocates don't want to talk about, because it shows that the translators had an awareness to some degree of the issue of textual variance. Okay? Let's go on. The use of the margin for alternative readings was controversial, because as Miles Smith explains in the preface to the King James Version, such a show of uncertainty could shake belief in the authority of the scriptures for deciding of controversies. He therefore mounts a carefully argued defense of the practice, noting that nothing essential to salvation is ambiguous, but that there are instances such as, quote, rare names of certain birds, beasts, and precious stones, when it is better to be honest about uncertainty than to dogmatize upon this, or to be
peremptorily,
which is a word that I'm assuming means presumptuous about what something means. Okay, so understand what they're doing here. Okay, so are they noting in the margin, number one, are they noting where there are Hebrew and Greek words that could go one way or the other, that could go this way or that way, that would be both acceptable translations? They're doing that, and they're noting some textual variance, and then they're explaining in the preface why. Okay? The more difficult Hebraisms and Grecisms were consigned to the margin. So if there was a difficult Hebrew or Greek idiom, or figure of speech, or phrase, or whatever, they would use the margin to explain that. You with me so far? So again, this is what Ward's saying they did retrospectively in 1618. The translation of Tobit and Judith, when any discrepancy is found between the Greek and the Old Vulgate Latin, they followed the Greek text by preference. So that's what Ward's saying. The Old Vulgate Latin refers to Jerome's translation from the Aramaic text of the apocryphal books of Judith, of Tobit and Judith. The text was based on the Greek rather than on the lost Hebrew originals. The Greek text followed by preference is the Septuagint. So there's a lot we could get into there, but I'm not going to right now. Just looking at what Ward said here. Look at the next part. Words that it was anywhere necessary to insert into the text to complete the meaning were to be distinguished by another type, small Roman. And we talked about that last time, right? What is that? That's the use of italics, essentially. That is him saying why they added the italics. He's saying this in 1618. Why did they add the italics? Ward says, words that it was anywhere necessary to insert into the text to complete the meaning. So those words were necessary to insert in English so that the English would make what? Make sense. Okay? And they are upfront enough to say, we put this word here because it needed to be here to complete the thought in English, even though there is no corollary Hebrew or Greek word for this. But if we leave this word out, this isn't going to make any, this word or this phrase or whatever, this isn't going to make any sense. So we're putting it in. So this is Ward's testimony. New arguments were affixed to every book and new headings to every chapter. We talked about that last week as well. An argument is a summary of contents, but in the end, arguments were never prefixed to the books of the Bible. Headings were, however, furnished for each chapter. A very perfect genealogy and map of the Holy Land was to be joined to the work, and that's from Campbell 40 through 42. Okay? So, if we're going to see the totality of this, we have to understand the difference between the rules that are drafted before the process begins and the retrospective account of Ward looking back. Okay? So, are there a few things that Ward talks about that weren't mentioned in the 14 or 15 rules? There are, okay? So let's look at, so let's stop there. Anybody got any questions or comments before we look at the procedure and practice?
It says here that the arguments were never prefixed to the books of the Bible. Are those arguments recorded somewhere?
They were never, in other words, he talks about that, but that was not something that was ever actually done. So here's first John. Okay, so I had this open for a different reason. But here's a page from the 1611, here's first John. Is there a chapter argument or outline, if you will, for here's chapter 1, here's chapter 2, is there stuff there? But is there anything for the whole book?
No.
There's nothing, there's no like introduction to the book. There's chapter headings, but there's no book introduction or book argument. You guys following that? Okay. So that's what he's talking about. So if you go back to the bottom of page 2, so you're talking about that last sentence? Amy, were you talking about the last sentence on page 2?
Yes.
An argument is a summary of contents, but in the end, arguments were never prefixed to the books of the Bible. Headings were, however, furnished for each chapter. So these would be the headings, the chapter headings, but there were no book arguments. They never did it. I don't know if they ran out of time, or they decided that they didn't need it, or what have you, but that part of it was never done. But there were chapter headings, no book arguments, is what Campbell's saying there, okay? Alright, so, let's go back. All right, okay, any other questions before we move on to the next point? Or sub-point? Alright, Sylvia, can we, on page 3 there in italics, can we change that to procedures, plural? Procedures in practice? Not, procedure? Okay, so, in addition to laying out a summary of the document that Samuel Ward submitted to the Synod of Dort in 1618, recapping the translational procedures utilized by the King James translators, Gordon Campbell comments on what these practices look like, look like in practice. Quote, perhaps the most impractical of the rules was number 8. So go to your other sheet. Let's look at number 8. Number 8. Every particular man of each company to take the same chapter or chapters and having translated or amended them severally by himself where he thinketh good, all to meet together, confer what they have done, and agree on their parts of what shall stand. So what he's going to say, what Campbell's going to say here is related to 8. So what is 8 saying? 8 is saying that if there are 6 of us that are assigned Genesis or Deuteronomy, you go home, I go home, everybody goes home and we do our own. We all go through it by ourselves and then we come back together and we compare what everybody has individually, what everybody has individually, and then we what? Then we kind of decide as a group what we think it should say. Okay? So, when he's talking about number 8, this is the rule he's talking about. Let's look what he says. Perhaps the most impractical of the rules was number 8, which implied that all members of the company would translate or amend all the books that they had been assigned to the company. There is some evidence that in practice, the work was divided up. Okay? So in other words, let's say 5 of us are assigned to translate Genesis through Deuteronomy. Okay? What the rule says is I should do my own for all of it, Will should do his own for all of it, Mike should do his own for all of it, and Bart should do his own for all of it, and then we'll get together, right? There's evidence to suggest that what they did is they said, okay, I'll take Genesis, Mike take Exodus, Bart take Numbers, Will take Deuteronomy or whatever, and then when I'm done with my whole book, your whole book, et cetera, then we'll get together and talk about it. Not that we'll all do our own for the whole section. Okay? Now here's why he says this. There's some evidence that in practice the work was divided up. The contemporary biographer of John Boyce, a member of the Cambridge Company responsible for the Apocrypha, says that, quote, part of the Apocrypha was allotted to him. So this is in his notes, in his diary. And when he had finished his own part, at the earnest request of him to whom it was assigned, he understood a second. So that suggests that he had his own one. section. And that when he finished his section, he said, I'm done with what you've assigned me. And then they said, well, here's another what? Part or another section. Similarly, one manuscript list now in the British Library of the 10 members of the Westminster Company responsible for the book for the books from Genesis to 2 Kings divides the company into two groups. One responsible for the Pentateuch and the other for the remaining books in their section. So let me, I believe I have a picture of this. Let me just confirm that. That's another reason why I wanted to bring this book in. Because you get a lot of interesting detail. Yes, okay. So, you can see here, so this is another document in the possession of the British Museum. So this is the first Westminster Company, I believe. Yep, Westminster Company that is assigned Genesis through 2 Kings. Okay? And you can see the Pentateuch and then the history books are divided here into two different what? Into two different groups, right? So I'll bring this over here so you guys can see what I'm talking about. Look where my two fingers are. So this would suggest, this document suggests strongly that of this company, they divided into two different groups or two different sections, and a handful of the men took Genesis through Deuteronomy, and the others took basically Joshua through 2 Kings, okay? But that they divided the work up in that way. So in other words, imagine if every guy by themselves had to do Genesis through 2 Kings, all by their onesies, everybody. And then they gotta come back and they gotta compare, right? So what I'm saying is the historical evidence in both the notes of John Boyce and in this document in the British Museum suggests that at least in some parts of the work was divided up into smaller chunks, and then a group of men worked on those chunks. And then they would come back together and discuss the whole thing. Okay, now, is everybody following that? Now, that's important. The reason that's important is because it shows that Rule 8 was probably viewed more as a guideline than a what? Than a rule. The surviving evidence suggests that at least in some places and cases across the project, every man did not do his own individual translation of it. And like I showed you right there in the document, there's strong evidence to suggest that they did it in sections. Okay. Now, any questions about that before we move on?
Mm-hmm. You might get to it. So, as they're approaching each of their individual assignments, and they've got these rules set forth by Bancroft, did they basically, is there any evidence, I guess, that would suggest that they basically looked at that and said, yeah, you know, this is an impractical approach, we're just going to do our own thing? Or was there like some need for permissions in order to deviate from the rules as set forth? Or
so if there was any formal request for permissions, there's no evidence, no surviving extant evidence to suggest it. What I just showed you there and what we can observe in the notes of Boyce suggests that there was some latitude for them to make some deviations from some deviations for practical reasons from some of that stuff.
So the understanding then would have been that those were guidelines as
opposed
to strict rules.
Yeah, you know, like I said last time, and it's more like, you know, the pirate code.
Yes.
They're more like guidelines than rules, okay? Yeah, Bart.
If they were individually translated and they came back together, what were they going to be discussing?
Each individual's translation of the whole thing.
Oh, so everybody was...
The way Rule 8 is worded would be that all these guys in this company... So, let me find the picture again. The first Westminster Company, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 guys, would all do their own work on the whole swath from Genesis to 2 Kings, individually, and then get together and talk about it, what they individually have for the whole thing. What the document, if you look at the brackets, what the document suggests, so here's Westminster, First Westminster Company, you see how the brackets branch off and then there's these two here? Mm-hmm. These are the ones that are doing Genesis through 2 Kings, okay? So they clearly were not doing it the way exactly that according to the letter of the law that is drawn up by Rule 8. Okay? But here's why I'm making a point about this. Many defenders of the King James, they come to Rule 8, and they're like, oh yeah, they did what it, you know, they just assume that they did it exactly the way the rule said. And what I'm saying is the evidence suggests that they took some liberties on how they worked. The thing already took, what, 6 years? 7 years? I think it would have taken infinitely more longer if they didn't do it in the way that they did it. Imagine having to go through all each one of the 10 guys' individual work on the whole thing. You had a question in the back?
I did. But how did they know, if the ones that were going to discuss each part, how did the other ones know what they were discussing? Because they weren't given that part to discuss. I mean, they didn't.
Well, that's why.
They didn't go through and read.
Well, yeah, that's why at the end, as we talked about last time, there's a general meeting, where the two representatives of each company will bring their work to a final general meeting where then the whole thing would be discussed. We'll talk more about that next week. But that's how that happens. But, so that's a bit of a shortcut, right? To take Genesis or 2 Kings and say, okay, there's 10 of us, you 5 take this, we 5 will take that, we'll do it, and then we'll still convert and convene about our assigned section, but we're not going to take the time to do it individually when we could do it our whole section together. Okay? Yeah.
So that was my question. Were there, instead of 10 doing each one, was there 5 at least doing the same translation and then comparing so that they had some issues to compare? Because otherwise, bringing back summaries that were this, you know.
That's a great. So in other words, what your question is then is,
were there more than
so of these five that are doing Genesis through Deuteronomy? Does each one of the 5 do their own of Genesis through Deuteronomy, or do they do all of Genesis to Deuteronomy together as a group? That's your question, and the answer to that question is I don't know. I don't know. What I do know though is that they all 10 did not do their own individual for all 10, for that whole section. So whether the chunk of 5 each did their own for that portion and then discussed it amongst themselves versus they just sit together in a room and they do the whole thing together as a group of 5, I don't know the answer to that, but that's a good question. But what I do know is that there is a latitude taken with Rule 8. That much is clear. Okay, let's go back. The rule that seems to have been broken most often is number 2. So look at number 2 on your other page. Number 2, the names of the prophets and holy writers with the other names of the text to be retained as nigh as may be accordingly as they are vulgarly used. So in other words, should they spell Isaiah the same way the whole time? In English. That's what it's saying. So let's look at the rest of this, okay? So the rule that seems to have been broken most often is Rule 2 on the spelling of proper names. Isaiah, the English name of the prophet, derives from the abbreviated form of his Hebrew name used in the title of his book. A fuller Hebrew form is used in the text. It must, however, have been the precedent of the bishop's Bible that caused the revisers to call him Esi in the 1611 in 2 Kings chapter 19 verse 2. So let's look at this. Get your Bible and go to 2 Kings. Actually, that's not going to work because it's fixed. We need to go here. So you're going to have to bear with me for a second. We need, what is it? 2 Kings. Tell me the reference.
19:2.
2 Kings 19:2, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So here we have the page from the 1611 Bible. I think. Is that the right reference?
It's there.
I'm not seeing it. Where is it?
Toward the end.
Here?
No, back up. Right there.
Why can I not see it?
2 ESAI.
Here, Essie, okay, got it. So, what do they have in that verse? How do they spell it? They spell it the way it's in the notes, right? Okay. So we can do now another level check on this. We can put in what did we? 2 Kings. We're gonna just do this for a few of these, just so that you get the point. 2 Kings 19:2, right? So we are going to say enter there, and then we are going to switch this to the Bishop's Bible, if it works. I love it when stuff works well.
Did anybody have a problem with keeping the name common, or they just wanted to be as accurate as possible, or what?
It has to do with differences between Hebrew and Greek and English and you know how things should be spelled. Oh, I don't have the S on Kings, so now I won't find it. So it's being temperamental. It's my mistake the whole time. There it is. Okay. So here's the bishop's text. How did they spell it? So why does the 1611 spell it like that? 1611 spells it like that because that's how what spelled it? It's how the bishop spelled it. Okay, so are they following rule one? Now you're sitting here saying, well, why is this? This is, again, a difference just in typography and how words are spelled, okay? But this is the same word, it's just a difference between the way the word is spelled in when the bishops is translated versus, but here it is, ESAI. Same thing here, right? So my point is, are they following the bishops?
Yes.
Yeah. So much so that they spell the word exactly the same way the bishops what? Spelled. Had the words. So go back to your notes, okay? It must, however, have been for the precedent of the king, precedent of the bishop's Bible that caused the revisers to call him essay in the 1611 text of 2 Kings 19:2. From 1629 onwards, the name was spelled how? Isaiah. So take your Bible and go to 2 Kings 19 and look at verse 2. In your Bible, it's going to be spelled the way that we are accustomed to the word being spelled, but that's not the way it was spelled where? In the 1611. If you go to 2 Kings 19:2, you'll see at the last clause of the verse, to Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, and how is Isaiah spelled? The way you're used to seeing Isaiah what? Spelled, okay? But you can see the 1611 clearly followed the spelling of the bishop's Bible. Let's go back to the notes. On the 21 occasions in which he appears in the New Testament, talking about Isaiah, however, the name is spelled Isaias. It's Greek form, okay? So you know that already because if you go to, well, let's just do it this way. Let's go to Mark chapter 1. So we're going to go in the 1611 now, and I'm going to find Mark chapter 1. And I prefer to load the page from the actual 1611 because you can see clearly what's going on. Here we see Mark chapter 1, verse 2. Actually, that's not the verse I was thinking of. I was thinking about the fact that the modern version changes that verse and kind of got confused there for a second. But even in your Bible, if you look up the word in the New Testament, Isaiah is often spelled how? It's often spelled with this way. So let me just find an example, because now I said we're going to find one and I messed up. So just bear with me for a second. E-S, how is it spelled?
E-S-A-I-A-S,
right? Yeah. So here we go. Matthew 3:3. Go to Matthew 3:3. Now, we're not going to do this in class for the Jeremiah example. You'll just take my word for it since we did it for this one. But look in your Bible, Matthew 3:3. So what you have in front of you is a 1769 edition of the King James Bible. And notice the spelling of it. Look at verse 3. For this is he that was spoken by the prophet who? Isaiah. So that's the old spelling, right? So Isaiah is spelled in the 1611 at least two different ways, if not three. But rule two said they should have what? Consistency in the spelling, right? And there is not consistency in the spelling. Yeah.
There's some wiggle room there. It says as nigh as may be in rule two. So that means as close as possible.
Here's what it tells us though, okay? The first example was from 2 Kings. The second example is from the New Testament. When they sat down to finalize this thing, was anybody like, whoa, 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 time out, these aren't spelled the same? Obviously that didn't happen. Okay, let's go back to the notes. Similarly, Jeremiah is so spelled in the Old Testament, but in Matthew's Gospel he appears as Jeremy on three occasions. Chapter 2, verse 17, chapter 16, verse 14, and chapter 27, verse 9, in the 1611 text. In modern text for the King James, as Jeremy, so just the difference in spelling, may be relieved to know that is not vulgarly called Jerry. So, rules formulated in advance of a project are inevitably adjusted to accord with the particularities of the job. In the case of the King James Version, there is evidence both of shortcuts and going the extra mile. Okay, so in some cases, are there clear shortcuts taken on the rules? But then there's other examples that we can look at of where they actually do even more than the rules required on certain other points, okay? So Campbell's commentary highlights a dynamic interplay between the various rules as the translators did their work. Sometimes rule one took precedence over another. Other times, rules were not consistently followed across the totality of the work. The exchange between rules 1, 2, and 3 make for an interesting case study. Rule 1, the ordinary Bible used in the church, commonly called the Bishop's Bible, to be followed and as little altered as the truth of the original will permit. Number 2 is what we were just talking about, the names of the prophets and holy writers, with their names in the text to be retained. And then rule 3, the old ecclesiastical words to be kept. Visit the word church, not to be translated congregation, etc. Okay? So I'm moving a little quicker now because we only got 15 minutes and I want to get through this two pages before we quit. In lesson 137, the Bishop's Bible, Understanding the King James Connection, we discuss the commonly held view among King James advocates that Rule 1 was ignored by the translators in favor of Rule 14. I listened to three videos this week. Two of the guys say flat out in these videos that Rule 1 was not followed. Okay? They say Rule 14 was the one they followed and they followed Tyndale. That's a misunderstanding of what's going on. Rule 14, the translations to be used when they agree better with the text than the Bishop's Bible, visa Tyndale, Matthew's, Coverdale's, Whitchurch's, which is the Great Bible, and Geneva. Interested parties are encouraged to revisit the full citations from the pens of Peter, from the pens of Peter S. Ruckman and Gerald Hammond on this matter in lesson 137. For our purposes in this lesson, the following abbreviated quotations from Ruckman will suffice. Number one, quote, Catholic rumors have always had it that the AV was based on the Bishop's Bible. He says it certainly was not. So what is he saying emphatically? He's saying emphatically that they did not follow what? Rule 1, which called for them to use the Bishop's Bible. The AV of 1611 is 90% the English of Tyndale. It is 90% the English of Tyndale because the bishops is 90% the English of who?
Tyndale.
Okay? Look at the second quote. It is interesting, as the common legend passed down from one university campfire to another, is that because the translators were ordered to follow the Bishop's Bible, they did. The truth is, they did not. Now, Ruckman is one of the leading lights of the King James Only movement, so-called, and he's emphatically telling his readers and the people that are following him that they did not follow Rule 1. It's a Catholic folklore, it's a university campfire story, it's not true, they didn't do that. That's what he's saying, right? Am I putting words in his mouth? I am not. More recent scholarship by Ward S. Allen, David Norton, and Lawrence M. Vance, among others, reveals that Ruckman was dead wrong in his assertions quoted above. In his 2015 book, The Making of the King James Bible New Testament, conducted a full collation of the New Testament found with a 1602 Bishop's Bible and the authorized 1611 authorized version. After conducting this collation, Vance found that, quote, the approximate percentage of the text of the authorized version that basically reads as the bishop's Bible is 91% of the New Testament. 91% is exactly the way the bishop's what?
Reads.
As we will see in a future lesson, the evidence is overwhelming that Rule 1 was followed and that the bishop's Bible served as the base text for the entire project. In fact, Rule 1 may have been the most followed rule of all. This, of course, would mean once again that a leading light in the King James Only movement was completely wrong and did not know what he was talking about. Let me show you. In this book, I get irritated about this stuff because I listen to these guys. And I said stuff that I got from a lot of these books and things that just totally isn't true. Here is the document in the Bodleian Library called Bod 1602. We'll talk more about this, right? This is the bishop's Bible, and these are the handwritten notes of the translators in the margin. They literally sat down when they did their work and worked off of a bishop's Bible as their base text. And you, if you take these notes in the margin and you compare a 1602 bishop's Bible with a 1611 King James Bible, you will see that these notes are their notes that they wrote in the margin, literally transforming the bishop's Bible into the King James. But here we have a guy who's supposed to know what he's talking about, telling everybody that it's a campfire story and a Catholic folktale that they followed Rule 1. When they absolutely followed Rule number 1, and there's documentable evidence of it in a British library. Okay? So I get a little fired up about this, I'm just saying. Because this has led to so many problems in this whole arena of discussion here because of things that have been said. And then people will get upset with me for showing them the truth about this because I'm going against stuff like what we just see in these two quotes here from Ruckman, stuff that was said that is just absolutely false. It's not true at all, never was true. But here's what happens, right? People read Ruckman, and they're like, oh, well, he must know what he's talking about. And so they just repeat it like parrots, and eventually it's just the standard way, and nobody questions it. Okay? So the comments cited above from the pen of Gordon Campbell, are we done with that quote? Yeah, we're done with the previous. The comments cited above from the pen of Gordon Campbell accent the interchange between the various rules as the translators set about to do their work. Let's consider the interplay between Rule 1 and Rule 2 as an example. We kind of did this already. Recall that Campbell said that Rule 2 regarding the spelling of the names was broken more frequently than any other rule. The name Isaiah, with the modern spelling, occurs 32 times in 32 verses in the Old Testament in a King James Bible. Okay? So if you look at that spelling, let's do it, since I hate it when people just take my word for stuff. Too much of that is why we end up with Ruckman saying stuff that's not true. Here we have Isaiah. Notice 2 Kings. So that's been fixed. Okay? But let's look at 2 Kings 19:5. Okay? 2 Kings 19:5. So we already did this earlier, so hopefully I can call this up pretty quick just by going back. Okay, here's 2 Kings, verse 2, we said SE, right? There. Let's go a few verses later to verse 5. How's it spelled in verse 5?
Isaiah.
Isaiah. Let's go one more level deep. And let's change this and go to verse 5. Now see, here's an inconsistency, because here's the bishops, and how do the bishops spell it in verse 5? So it's like they missed one, and nobody what? Because there it is. There it is right there. The bishops had it the same both ways, but the King James translators, they change it in verse 5, but they left it the other way in verse what? In verse 2. Okay? So bottom of page 4. The name Isaiah with the modern spelling, I just showed you that. There it is right there. In 2 Kings 19:2, the only time that Isaiah was spelled the older way, spelling Esi, in the 1611 edition. So it's like they missed one time, nobody caught it. Okay. Meanwhile, the 1602 text had Esi, the older spelling, in all 32 verses. So I already checked on this stuff. In all 32 verses that the prophet is named in the Old Testament. Aside from the one outlier in 2 Kings 19:2, the translators updated and standardized the spelling of Isaiah in the 1611 Old Testament. In contrast, the word Isaias, the old Greek spelling of Isaiah, occurs 21 times in 21 verses in the King James New Testament. A comparison with the 1602 Bishop's Bible reveals that every time the Old Testament prophet is mentioned, his name is spelled Isaias, just as it appears in the 1611 New Testament. So we could do that. We don't have time. It's going to take too long, okay? But I challenge you, look up Isaias in the New Testament. I can send you the link. I'll put the link to the websites to do this. And then look it up in the bishops. And you'll see that in the New Testament, they never changed it. They just left it the way the bishops had it. But Rule 2 says they're supposed to standardize all this. Right? So, back to the next point. A comparison with the 1602 Bishop's New Testament reveals that every time the Old Testament prophet is mentioned, his name was spelled E-S-A-Y-A-S, which would be the way we already saw it spelled in Matthew, right? E-S-A-Isaias, right? Like that?
E-S-A-I-A-S.
Isaias. Go to Matthew 3 and let's just look at it. I got so much stuff going on right now. I'm getting all jumbled up on how to spell old spellings of English names. Matthew 3:3, E-S-A-I-S, right? Okay. So we could check that quickly enough. Let's do it. So we're going to look it up in the Bishop's Bible. And we want Matthew 3:3. There it is. How's it spelled?
E-S-A-Y.
Spelled the same way it's spelled where? Okay. So this Y would be the same as what? An I. Okay. So when given the chance. So herein we see, I'm halfway through the second point on page 5. Herein we see the tension between the various rules set forth to govern the project. When given the chance to standardize the spelling of Isaiah, Rule 2, the translators elected to follow the bishops in the New Testament and thereby adopt the old Greek spelling. When Rule 2 said what? To standardize that spelling. Okay? The same cannot be said for the Old Testament, where the older Hebrew spelling was updated in every place except what? One. We already looked at that, right? These realities except the preferences / priorities of the various, I think that should say accent. Except doesn't make sense there.
Except E-X.
Yeah, it should be E-X.
These realities except the preferences, priorities of the various translational companies as they did their work. I think it should still say accent, but circle it and I'll check it out later. However, it speaks to how strictly rules 8 through 10 were followed regarding the various companies reviewing each other's work. If they're all supposed to be reviewing each other's work, then and with a certain level of specificity, then why isn't somebody saying, well, wait a minute, we've got Isaiah spelled three different ways here. Two ways in the same chapter within three verses. Okay? However, it speaks to how strictly rules 8 through 10 were followed regarding the various companies reviewing each other's work. If those rules were followed the way they were written up, consistent adherence to Rule 2 was clearly not a priority, or the spelling of Isaiah would have been standardized throughout the whole biblical text. The same could be said for the spelling of Jeremiah, also noted above by Campbell. These observations raise questions as to how strictly Rules 8 through 10 were followed. Rule 3, regarding the use of old ecclesiastical words, is also interesting to consider in this context. In Lesson 141, we discussed how the 1568 Bishop's Bible was revised in 1572. One of the distinct features of the 1572 revision was the intentional choice to reintroduce ecclesiastical terminology back into the text. An example would be the use of the Latin word for charity, the Latin word charity for love in 1 Corinthians 13. The revision of 1572 used the word charity 28 times in 24 verses. These old ecclesiastical word changes passed forward into the 1602 bishop's text, which served as the base text for the King James translators. When one compares the 1602 base text with the authorized version of 1611, they will find occurrences of the word charity in the exact same 28 places. Okay? So, this is not, the translators weren't sitting there saying, charity would be a better word these 28 times. No. They inherited a text that had already made that change 28 times. The exact same 28 times it's in the King James Bible. And they are to follow Rule 1 unless the truth of the original said what? Otherwise. So in their mind, is charity and love perfectly capable of communicating the exact same one thing? Now, again, that's the factual reality of the situation. In many cases, following Rule 3 was as simple as following Rule 1. So following Rule 3, to use the ecclesiastical terms, all they had to do was follow Rule 1, because the bishops had already what? Put the ecclesiastical terms back in. So in many cases, following Rule 3 was as simple as following Rule 1, since the bishop's Bible had already revised in favor of more ecclesiastical language. Noting the interplay that existed between the various rules serves to highlight the priorities of the translators. Given the surviving evidence, it does seem that Rule 1 was probably the rule that was most strictly and consistently adhered to. Yet this is the rule that King James onlyists say nobody followed because it was a campfire story in a Catholic folklore. You can't make this stuff up, right? The one rule that seems to be followed with the most strictness and adherence is the very rule that Leading Lights in the King James Only movement has said is the rule they never followed and ignored. Okay? This much is clear. The rules were not followed like a hard and fast checklist. In the end, they served more as guidelines than rules. As Campbell pointed out above, quote, rules formulated in advance of a project are inevitably adjusted to accord with the practicalities of the job. In the case of the King James Version, there is evidence of both shortcuts and going the extra mile. Okay? So, look, guys, it seems like every lesson now, there's some sort of factual misinformation that we're having to correct about what has been said. But I am basing what I am saying on objective evidence. Okay? Not upon subjective preference, but on historical documentation that actually exists. Again, do we have a bishop's Bible, a 1602 bishop's Bible, with the handwritten notes of the translators in the margin? To say that Rule 1 was not followed is absolutely false and not true, and it never was true. So you say, well, how did they come by that? Well,
you'd love to come back for another lesson, won't you? All right, we're at our limit on time. I have to close this down. You folks that are here in person, if you have a question while I'm packing up, let me know. But I am going to shut the stream down. I want to thank those of you who have joined us for watching.